started, I do want to mention that back in that corner, we have cookies and juice being provided by the Dewbrook National Honor Society. It's for a goodwill offering. The money's going to go to some of their activities and scholarships. So even if you don't feel like you need a cookie, it's a good cause, and you should go give money anyway. So, with that, let's go ahead and call this to order. We're going to start the public input hearing, and this is a little unusual in that it addresses two dockets. The first is EL09-015. Now, that is a 300-megawatt, the 300-megawatt Deer Creek natural gas power plant and associated facilities. The second docket is HP09-002. This would be a 13.2-mile pipeline, a natural gas pipeline, which would be constructed to support that power plant, and it would traverse about 18 sections of land located in Brookings and Dual County. As you might imagine, the purpose for tonight's public input hearing is really twofold. The first off, we want to learn more about the project, and so we will have the applicant, Basin Electric, making some comments. We expect their presentation to take about 25 minutes or so. And then the second, and frankly more important purpose of tonight, is to hear from you all. Get your feelings and concerns about this project or your comments of support so that we can keep those things in mind as we move forward with this process. If you're interested more and want to see an application, I think you've got three great opportunities to do so. A copy is on file at the Brookings and Dual County Auditors. And then all of the information is posted on the Public Utilities Commission website. I'm not going to walk you through how to do that now, but any of the members of the Public Utilities Commission staff, which we'll introduce in a minute, will be able to walk you through how to find it on our website. But that, I think, is relatively user-friendly if you click on the Commission Actions link on the homepage. So right now we've just got two parties to this case. We've got the applicant, and we also have the Public Utilities Commission staff. But certainly there are opportunities for other local governments or really persons of any kind to become interveners and gain party status. And if you want to gain party status, you need to make that application by October 13th. Now, if your only interest in this project is wanting to make your voice heard, you need not get formal legal party status, but that is an opportunity that's available to you. And we have applications here tonight if you're interested, and you can just see any PUC staff member and they'll get you set up with that application. All right, for if the commission is to approve this application, the applicant really needs to prove four things. The first thing is that the facility will comply with all applicable laws and rules. The second is that the facility won't pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in that siting area. Number three, that it will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants. And finally, number four, that the facility will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region. And of course, we're very concerned about what local governments have to say about the development of this region. Now, based on those four factors, the commission is going to have three decisions before it. We can approve their permit, we can deny their permit, or we can approve their permit with whatever conditions we feel appropriate and allowable under law. Now we're going to start tonight again with the applicant making a presentation. When we get done with that, we'll have an opportunity for you to come up. It looks like we've got two microphones right there. Had anybody given any thought to whether we're going to have them come to those mics or run the mic around, or what's your preference? Okay, come to the microphones right there. I think it's really important that we have you do three things tonight. The first is sign up on the sign-in sheets in the back. Even if you don't plan to speak, we would like to have you sign up there because that is our record of who was here tonight and to what extent the community took an interest in this project. And so I think that sign-in sheet is very important. Second, we need to have you, when you come to that microphone, say your name and where you come from, where you're living now, so we have an idea of who you are. And then we need to have you speak, finally, loudly and clearly. We do have a court reporter this evening who is taking note of everything we say, and we want to make sure we get everything you're saying right in the record. So with that, My name is Dusty Johnson. I'm a commissioner of the Public Utilities Commission, as are my colleagues Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. We've got a number of commission staffers here that I will introduce. First off, the folks who are on the staff side, they don't get to talk to us about this proceeding because they're representing the public interest. We're the decision makers, and they're a party to the case. First, we've got Karen Kramer. And Ms. Kramer has been an assistant attorney general for the state of South Dakota in one of two departments for 23 years. We've got Tim Binder, who's a staff analyst. Tim is a research and analytical expert, and this is his fourth siting docket. We've got Brian Rounds. Mr. Rounds is an electrical engineer. This is his ninth siting docket. We've got Nathan Solem, who is a certified pipeline inspector with 30 years of experience in engineering, and this is his 10th siting docket. We've got Stacy Splitstoser. She's a certified pipeline inspector and is also a registered engineer, and this is her fourth siting docket. And that's the folks on the staff side. And then advising the commission on this proceeding, we have Mr. Greg Rizlov, who has been with the commission for 33 years, and his area of expertise is economic analysis. We've got John Smith, who is our general counsel, and some of his areas of expertise are environmental and business law, and those two gentlemen advise the commission. So with that, I'm going to pause and see if my colleagues have anything to add. Yeah, I should note, I mentioned there were only two interveners to this case. That's not accurate. There is a third party that has been granted that status by the commission. That's Iberdrola, which is a wind developer in this area. So, unless there's any preliminary business at this point, Ms. Jacobson, we would turn it over to you to introduce your team or proceed in any way that you as the applicant see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, members of the public, my name is Casey Jacobson, and I'm an attorney at Basin Electric Power Cooperative. With me this evening, other attorneys are Russ Mather, who's behind me, also from Basin Electric, and our local counsel, Gene LeBrun and Miles Schumacher from Lynn Jackson, Schultz and LeBrun. Additionally, I'd like to take a moment to introduce some of the members of our cooperative family who are with us this evening. First is Bob Saar, General Counsel of East River, and Scott Parsley, Assistant Manager of Member Services also at East River. From Sioux Valley, we have Henning Hansen, a board member of Sioux Valley Energy, Don Marker, CEO, General Manager of Sioux Valley, as well as Ted Smith, Manager of Engineering. And additionally, from HG Electric Cooperative, we have Matt Hotzler, who's the General Manager, as well as three board members here, Dale Olson, Dale Williams, and Steve Hansen. Thank you for attending. As the chairperson stated, we have a short half-hour presentation we'd like to present to you this evening. There are approximately four employees of Basin Electric. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Gavin McCollum, the project manager for the Deer Creek Station.
Thank you, Casey, and thank you, commissioners. As Casey mentioned, my name is Gavin McCollum. I'm the project manager of the Deer Creek Station project. I'm a registered engineer, and I've worked for Basin Electric for 18 years. I was assigned this task as project manager in 2007. I want to express my appreciation and a chance to address you and the members of the public to tell a little bit about the Deer Creek Station. We think we have an extremely good project here. We have a project that we think is good for the environment, a project that's good for the community that we serve and for our members. And so with that, I will get right into it with our presentation. To my left, we have Becky Kern, a power supply engineer. She will talk about the marketing aspects of the project. She'll go first. I'll talk a little bit about the technical aspects. Chris Miller to Becky's left is our senior environmental coordinator. He will talk about the environmental aspects. And at the end of the table is Kurt Pearson, our project coordinations representative. He's kind of our community guy out in the street, so to speak. We also have, in addition to the folks that I just mentioned, we have more of Basin Electric staff behind us representing engineering, construction, and right-of-way. We also have the folks listed on the screen there, and those are some of the consultants that have helped us as we've gotten this far. And any of us that are here at this table or the folks behind me at the table behind me will be available to any if anybody has any questions after this takes place. So that I'll turn it over to Becky Kern and talk about the marketing aspects of the Deer Creek Station.
Good evening. I'm Becky Kern. I've been with Basin Electric for almost 7 years now. I'm a power supply engineer in our marketing and power supply planning division at Basin Electric. I'm going to give kind of a high-level overview of who Basin Electric is and then talk briefly about how we determined that we needed the Deer Creek Station. Basin Electric is a member-owned and controlled wholesale power supply cooperative that serves the supplemental power to our members above the hydropower allocation. This map here on the screen shows our member service territory. Our service territory, our member service territory, spans 9 states. We have 136 members that all belong to one of the members shown on the screen. We serve 100% of the rural electric cooperative load within the state of South Dakota. And all of our members across the 9-state region serve 2.8 million consumers. We go into Basin's generating facilities and how we meet all of our member obligations. I'm going to start here with our existing coal and nuclear-based generation that Basin has. The screen here shows the existing resources that Basin Electric either operates or has a power purchase agreement out of. As of September 1st, Basin Electric had a new member join our family, and with that, we have purchased the output of several facilities in the state of Iowa that included the Wisdom 1 and then a portion of Duane Arnold, Walter Scott's units 3 and 4, and then a portion out of Neal 4 again. We currently have under construction a coal-based facility near Gillette, Wyoming called the Dry Fork Station to be online in 2011. With all of this coal nuclear-based generation, we've got approximately 2,900 megawatts of generation. If we look at the wind generation facilities that Basin Electric either owns or has power purchases from, these are the existing facilities. We're located in North Dakota, South Dakota, and a small one in Minnesota. As of September 1st, we've purchased the output out of 3 additional projects in Iowa, and we have several projects that we are either under construction or have committed to buy the output out of, all to be online within the next year. Those new projects are located in North Dakota and in South Dakota. Once all these projects are online, we will have approximately 600 megawatts of wind generation in our portfolio. We also buy the output of currently 6 waste heat or recovered energy generation facilities along the Northern Border Pipeline, and 2 more projects that are going to go online later this year. So we will have a total of 8 sites with 44 megawatts. If we look at the natural gas and oil generation in our portfolio, we've got several facilities that are currently operating in Wyoming, South Dakota, and then Iowa. With the new September 1st member that joined Basin Electric, we've added several new facilities in the state of Iowa. And then if we look at the projects that are committed to or under construction, we've got the Culbertson Generation Station that is under construction in Montana to be online in 2010, and then the Deer Creek Station that we are here talking about tonight. With all of these facilities, once they're all online, we'll have approximately 800 megawatts of natural gas or oil generation in our portfolio. If we look at the analysis that was done to determine that the Deer Creek Station was the right project for Basin Electric, back in 2007, we performed a power supply analysis that evaluated Basin Electric's obligations and our ability to meet all of our power supply obligations. We started with a load forecast that evaluated the time period of 2006 through 2021. This graph just shows where our existing system demand has been and what it was forecasted to do. Between the years 2006 and 2021, we had forecasted we'd have 1,834 megawatts of load growth. Since that time, we've had an additional load forecast that was completed that there has been a slowdown in some of the load growth, but we have added additional load obligations that have come since that time period, such as the Trans-Canada pipeline that's going to be going through Montana and South Dakota. We look at the major areas of growth within Basin Service Territory. We've got coal bed methane development in the state of Wyoming, oil development in the state of Montana and western North Dakota, as well as rural residential growth in Iowa and in South Dakota, and then ethanol development in South Dakota and Iowa. During this process, we evaluated several different resource options as our determine what our need was in determining how we are going to meet that. We evaluated baseload facilities, combined cycle, distributed generation, load management. Combined cycle, distributed generation, and then load management, along with all the other facilities that are, or types of resources that are listed on this graph. Once we evaluated all those resource types, we came up with a preferred resource portfolio that is met by this graph here. We determined that we needed some magnitude of additional wind generation, which is being met by those facilities that are under construction or going to be built in the next year. We determined we needed two additional peaking type generation facilities. That was the Groton Unit 2 facility that went commercial in 2008 and the Culbertson Generation Station that's going to be going online in 2010. I will come back to the intermediate piece in just a moment. We also determined that a baseload component would be preferred within our resource expansion portfolio. We have not fully committed to a project here yet. We are still evaluating how and when baseload would fit best into our mix. As for the intermediate facility, we had determined approximately 250 megawatts was the magnitude of power that we needed that would meet an intermediate need, and the Deer Creek Station is the project that would meet that need. We talk about the Deer Creek Station here. It's a combined cycle unit that is capable of meeting an intermediate generation need. During normal operations, it would have an output of roughly 250 megawatts. And then we also determined that adding a duct firing component to that would allow for an additional 50 megawatts of peaking generation that would be available during peak conditions. We had determined that the spring of 2012 was the timing that we needed this facility online. And we chose the site location near White, South Dakota for that facility. There's several different transmission lines that come into this area. Also, with the large amounts of wind that is being developed in the region, it's a kind of a extra bonus piece that we get that you site the natural gas facility near here, you may be able to combine wind and gas here. Also, the transmission study requests have been submitted and studies are underway for the transmission need for this project. With that, I'm going to pass it on to Gavin McCollum.
Thank you, Becky. I'm going to hit on some of the more technical or engineering aspects of the project briefly, and they'll hit those areas that are shown on the screen there, kind of in order. Project location is shown on the screen there in the green circle. It's about 6 or 8 miles southeast of where we sit tonight. It's near the WAPA substation and near the White existing Excel substation. Here's an aerial photo looking south. It shows that land I just described. On the left of the screen, you see 484th Street, and the WAPA substation is on 207th Avenue. And in the blue square is our proposed site. It's about 100 acres fenced on a 160-acre quarter section, which we own. We will develop between 40 and 50 acres within that blue square to serve as the plant site. Becky mentioned the combined cycle, and I don't want to get too technical or too deep into this, but I'll just briefly describe what that is. About 300 megawatts of capacity, like Becky mentioned. There's four major pieces of equipment in the plant, and those are shown schematically. There's a gas turbine, which is right here, that takes natural gas in, as we mentioned, and it fires that and turns a turbine to generate electricity. And it also takes the exhaust gas from a gas turbine and it runs it down into this device here, which is called a heat recovery steam generator. In a simple cycle facility, that waste gas is just sent out into the atmosphere. In a combined cycle facility, that waste gas is used to heat water to make steam, which is then turned into electricity through a steam turbine generator. So the end result is you get a very high efficiency, about 54% at the optimum conditions. That compares to about 41% for a simple cycled unit and about something in the low 30s for a coal-fired facility. So combined cycle plant is the most efficient plant you can get if you're going to burn fossil fuels. And while the combined cycle plant is Basin's first combined cycle, there's literally hundreds of these in the United States. That's a very mature technology, and it's a proven technology. This is just to give you a picture of what the plant would look like on a drawing. It's kind of a 3D rendition, but it's kind of hard to see. So we had some folks put together a 3D rendering of the plant with the right colors and everything. And this is what it would look like on that picture, which is actually the picture of the land that we have purchased. And I'll just show you in that area there is where the gas turbine sits. The steam turbine is there. This is the heat recovery steam generator where the stack is about 150 feet tall. And this is the air-cooled condenser. One thing about the air-cooled condenser, it's a closed system. It's not an open system with a wet-cooled. There's not a big steam cloud that comes out of the top of it. It's very clear. It's like a radiator of your car. It just runs air through there and it condenses that steam back into water. Natural gas pipeline is shown in the yellow there. It's about 13 miles from the northern border site to the Deer Creek site. It's a 10-inch pipeline. I'm sorry, 13 miles. Yeah. It'll be a 10-inch line, and that will be sized for a possible second unit if it ever comes to pass that we need more electricity down in this area and we need to add another unit. We will not have to add a new pipeline or dig this one up and put another one in. It will be sized for two units. It'll operate between 475 and 900 PSI normally. However, it is designed to comply with the maximum pressure of the northern border pipeline, which is about 1,400 PSI. It'll be at least 4 feet underground everywhere. It'll be operated by us, and it's currently being designed, and it will be installed by MDU, who we've hired to do that work. Just a few pictures that MDU gave us of some typical gas pipeline installations, just to show you what that entails. I want to point out something on the top left picture there is that they have two piles of dirt, one on either side of the trench, and they do separate the topsoil from the soil underneath. And then, of course, then they put that back in the right order, so then when you're all done, you can continue to use that land the same as you did before we got there. Other than we do install a few markers periodically to remind you that that gas pipeline is there. Transmission line, Becky mentioned it's a fairly short transmission run from our site to the White WAPA substation, about 3/4 of a mile. So that's a good thing that we don't have to run a lot of transmission line over the countryside. Typical transmission towers are shown on the left. Water supply, the process water will be used as groundwater, or groundwater will be used as process water, through a well site, which we've selected about a mile and a half south of the site. Of the plant site. We plan to install a 6-inch underground pipeline. Again, that will be sized for a second unit if it ever came to pass. We would install two 125 gallons per minute pumps, and one of those would 125 gallons per minute. And one of those would be primary, and one of those would be backup or redundant if one broke down. Normally, we would use about 24 gallons per minute to 58 gallons per minute, depending on summer or winter conditions. And that compares, I mentioned the dry cooling facility that we have planned. If it were a wet-cooled facility with the wet-cooled tower, we would use about 500 gallons per minute. So the water usage on this facility will be much less. We give up some efficiency with the dry cooling, but there's no large body of water to use around here, so we made the decision to go dry cooled. That compares to an ethanol plant, 100 million gallons per year ethanol plant uses anywhere from 300 to 700 gallons per minute, depending on what trade magazine you read. So we think we're good as far as water usage goes. We did hire Burns and McDonald out of Kansas City to do a transportation study for the project. Just some highlights of that are shown here. This is a diagram that shows the highways and the roads in the area. And what they've recommended is that we funnel traffic to minimize the impacts, and the traffic patterns are shown here. From the traffic from the south on the construction would be taken to 482nd Avenue and up to 207th Street and then up to the plant site. Traffic from the north would come down 484th Avenue over 207th Street and up to the plant site. We do have some heavy hauls planned for the larger equipment, and that heavy haul route would be shown here. It'd be railed into Aurora, it'd be over east on Highway 14 and driven up north on 484th Street. There is one weak bridge just south of our plant site that we plan to span with a jumper bridge temporarily for the period of time when the heavy hauls are done. And that would then be removed when the project is built. Briefly, right away, we've purchased about 94% of the gas pipeline easements, 30 out of 32 landowners. Overall, the project is about 81% of the right away is acquired, and mainly that's we haven't gotten the design of the route for the water line finalized or the transmission line finalized yet. So once those easements are written up, you know, the surveys and such, then we can get going full speed on those right aways also. We have also purchased, like I mentioned, the plant site land. Last for me is the project schedule. It's shown here. The red line is where we are tonight, so we've already done a lot of development work and procurement, and we've started work on the permitting, obviously. If all goes well, we hope to start construction in July of next summer. And that'll be an 18-month construction period. The little blue blob there is represents the gas pipeline construction. That'd be done right away, and then the rest of the plant would be after that. We hope to start up in commissioning, and then, as Becky mentioned, a commercial operation date of June of 2012. I'll pass it over to Chris to talk about the permitting efforts.
Thank you, Gavin. My name is Chris Miller. I'm a senior environmental project administrator for Basin Electric. I've been providing environmental services to Basin Electric for approximately 19 years. Yes. The major permitting efforts for this project include the energy conversion and transmission facility siting for the South Dakota PUC. That's why we're here tonight. Also is required for the project is water and air permitting efforts from the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources. In addition, environmental impact statement is being conducted. Western Area Power Administration and the Rural Utility Service are our lead agencies. In addition, there will be county and local permits such as conditional use, building, road crossings, etc. from the road crossing and building from the counties of Brookings and Dual Counties. The environmental resources that were evaluated to support this permitting activity, including analysis of the physical environment, which includes an evaluation of landforms and topography, geology, soils and economic deposits, erosion and sedimentation, hydrology, which includes analysis of surface water drainage, water use and sources, terrestrial ecosystems. They included analysis of vegetative communities, wildlife, and threatened and endangered species. Aquatic ecosystems was also evaluated. That include studies of fisheries, wetlands, water quality. Evaluation was surface and groundwater impacts. And also for air quality, there are class one and class two evaluations. Solid and radioactive waste. And finally, land use and land use controls, which include existing land use restrictions and noise. Noise is one area I'd like to expand on a little bit because I know it's important to the public and certainly to the commission. This drawing is, I'll identify as Gavin showed, here's our plant site, shows the general arrangement. We went out and we took baseline measuring points. There are three measuring points on property boundaries, and we did four measuring points that are near the nearby residences. The nearest resident is approximately a half mile from the property boundary. The study was performed by Burns McDonald's, and their process is we go out and they measure the existing baseline noise measurements. That's represented by this column here, the minimum measured noise levels. All the equipment that the Deer Creek project will be included, those vendors supply noise levels, and they have guarantees behind them. All the equipment was then placed inside of a model, and that model indicated that the largest decibel reading would be 54 decibels, and that's right on our plant boundary. The nearest residence would be, the highest residence would be 45 decibels. And the last column here, which is the estimated total operational noise, is that baseline noise recording plus what our model noise levels would be. That highest level seen by a residence was 53 decibels. This next and final slide is a contour level. Again, the 45 decibel points is identified by this green contour, and which so the nearest residence is a half mile south and falls along the plant site. With that concludes my section. I'll turn it over to Kurt Pearson.
Good evening, commissioners and members of the public. I'm Kurt Pearson. I'm a project representative for Basin Electric on new construction projects, wherever they might be in North Dakota, Wyoming, or South Dakota, and have 32 years of experience with Basin Electric. This map and slide depicts the designated 12-mile radius affected area, and on the left is a listing of those public entities, cities, towns, and school districts, counties that are included in the potential affected area. On this slide, I have put together a depiction of the estimated construction workforce. And our pipeline workforce is approximately 70 workers, and it only takes place in the first 3 months of construction, and that's shown in the blue there. And then it drops down slightly and starts to build again. Our peak construction workforce is estimated to be about 360 workers, and that will take place in the June-July 2011 time frame. On the operational side, this plant will take 31 permanent staff, and this is the latest estimate from our manager that will be running this plant. You can see our first employee hire would be the plant manager, and we're estimating that person would be hired in May of 2010. And then we will be hiring throughout the year of 2011. We will have the full complement of 31 employees employed on site approximately 1 year before this power plant goes commercial. The reason for that is to make sure that they're part of the construction, they understand the plant, they're fully trained, so the day that the plant is declared commercial operation, they are totally competent and the plant is fully functional and fully staffed. So 31 permanent staff. These are good paying jobs. You can imagine a multi-million dollar power plant like this. We want highly trained, highly competent staff. So these are good jobs for the area. Basin Electric, when we do a power plant of this nature, of this size, we are guided by a membership resolution, E5, current resolution on impact alleviation. And the membership guides the Basin Electric management and staff on a host of different activities. But when it comes to impact alleviation, we have been guided by our members to involve the local communities, to involve the local economic development groups, to get engaged with them, to jointly plan with them to make sure that any potential impacts are identified early on and that the appropriate impact mitigation efforts can be implemented. To help us in that analysis, Basin Electric hired the First District Association of Local Governments, and with us tonight is Mr. Ted Hayter is our lead analyst from First District to help us answer any questions. Ted's sitting here in the audience. And then Professor Emeritus Randy Stufen, sitting to my right, has prepared an economic impact analysis for us. Both of these analyses are in Appendix C of the application. So When we look at the areas that a plant of this type might impact, we have to analyze the effects on the economy, the effects on the local infrastructure, the law enforcement, police, fire, social services, those things. We look at the population changes that might be brought about not only by the construction workforce, but by the operational workforce. We look at the effects on transportation, which has already been mentioned by previous presenters. And then we take recommendations for impact mitigation, and we work with the local governments to see what their thoughts are. So First District Association, under contract to Basin Electric, looked at these housing supplies. They looked at education. For instance, as an example, a most highest case would be 72 children coming into the area from all the 360 construction workers, and the school districts in this area can easily handle that many children coming into the area without any negative impacts. So as First District did their own analysis through all of these areas, they found that in only a couple areas were there some recommendations. Otherwise, there was no significant impact on the areas studied. In the area of wastewater, they recommend, of course, that we obtain the appropriate permits, and Chris Miller has already mentioned that we'll be approaching the appropriate agencies to get the permits. In the area of transportation, they do recognize that the heavy haul loads will require some improvement on the haul roads, dust control during construction, and obviously to, again, obtain the additional permits. First District's is a recommendation. The definitive analysis was done by Burns and McDonald, and Gavin's already mentioned that, and we have representatives from both here to talk about that. But the bottom line from First District's analysis is that after obtaining the appropriate permits and taking care of dust during construction, there are no significant negative impacts to the social and economic infrastructure of the affected area. And then we look at the economic impacts, the good and the bad, the employment, both temporary and permanent, the taking land out of agricultural use, is that going to have an impact? We look at the benefits that the commercial and industrial sectors might make from the sales of goods and services to the project while it's under construction and later. And we look at the payroll coming into the area, the personal income, and then the taxes that are spent in the area. And this is Professor Stufen's analysis on that. In construction, we have a project that's some $400 million, but taking a very hard and conservative look at that, we believe about $33 million of that, of the goods and materials to construct this plant will be purchased in South Dakota. So that's a direct outlay of about $33 million. During construction, there'll be about $26 million of value-added impact in the area, and that's the income that the workers will make while they're here in South Dakota. During construction, we have and we will be paying taxes, and the analysis shows that the total taxes and land purchase is about $4.8 million. In the area of loss of agricultural land, approximately 50 acres will be taken out of agricultural production, but Professor Stufen has determined that that will not result in a substantial employment loss in the county or the state. Of long-term impact, positive impact, is the annual operations. If you take a look at the 25, now you notice that number is lower than the 31 I said earlier because we use conservative numbers when we can. Our latest numbers are would be even higher than this. About $3.6 million of a direct and induced beneficial impact from the operational employees of this power plant. So thank you for your time tonight, and I'll turn this back over to Casey Jacobson.
Thanks, Kurt. That concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions from the commission or members of the public.
The commissioners have just agreed that we're going to hold off on our questions because we'll have lots of other opportunities, and we certainly want to hear from the audience. Just a couple of reminders. Again, your name first and location, and speak slowly and clearly. And then we still have cookies and stuff back there. Dubrook NHS? A lot? All right, you all are not doing your job. Let's support the youth of this area. So, yeah, feel free to you can get up to go to the bathroom or to buy cookies. All right, let's hear from you all. They can be questions, they can be comments of concern, they can be comments of support. Yes, Mr. Marker. Come on down.
Chairman Johnson, thank you. Members of the commission staff, my name is Don Marker. I'm general manager and CEO with Sioux Valley Energy, Coleman, South Dakota. As many of you know, Sioux Valley is responsible, is a not-for-profit, member-owned electric cooperative, and we are responsible for providing retail electric service throughout not only Brookings County, where we are here tonight, but in five additional counties surrounding this area. I do not want to offer extensive testimony this evening in support of this project in the interest of preserving the commission's time, but I would like to offer a letter of support and ask that that be introduced as part of this record if that so pleases the commission. If I may just very briefly summarize the contents of that letter of support. As you understand, our member consumers rely on Sioux Valley to provide safe, reliable, and affordable retail electric service to them. And we think through our membership in East River Electric and Basin Electric that this plant is an important component of providing, helping Sioux Valley meet our needs to serve that membership. In the last 10 years alone, Sioux Valley has seen its load demand for electric service increase by nearly 90% or almost double. That load growth comes really in two forms. It comes from adding additional members to the system, but also growth in electrical requirements from within our existing members. Over the next 10 years, we forecast ahead, as you understand, to determine not only our local distribution needs and capacities, but that's factored into the load forecasts that were provided by the Basin folks here this evening. And at the Sioux Valley local level that this plant will support, we forecast our loads to double again within the next 10 years. So if it pleases the chair, I would offer an original letter of our letter of support. There are additional copies in here that can be distributed to the members of the other commissioners or the staff or the public. And I would be willing at the appropriate time to answer questions if there are any. Thank you very much.
Sure, certainly, Mr. Marker, and you can go ahead and provide that to any member of the staff, and they will make sure that we get that entered into our public comment portion of our docket page. Other comments? Good evening, Matt.
Hello, my name is Matt Hutzler. I am the general manager of HD Electric in Clear Lake, South Dakota. And I would also like to submit a letter of support for the project. We serve dual counties, Hamlin counties, and the northeast portion of Brookings County. So we're just right near the area of this proposed plant. So I would like to submit this also, please.
Thanks, Mr. Hostler. I should mention that if you do have a letter, you certainly can let us know you have a letter, but if you're not comfortable speaking, you can simply get that letter after the fact to any member of our staff, and they'll make sure it's added to the record. Good evening, Mr. Starr.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and commissioners and commission staff and members of the public. My name is Bob Starr. I'm the general counsel for East River Electric, based in Madison, South Dakota. East River Electric is a power supplier for the cooperatives and one municipal system in eastern South Dakota and in western Minnesota. And just as a little background that I know the commissioner is familiar with, but just as a reminder, the cooperatives are owned by our members. And if you think about the cooperative chain, it really starts with the members' owners who are in the rural parts of this state and this region. And then you have the local distribution cooperatives such as HD and Sioux Valley and many others throughout the state and region. Then you have the transmission and power suppliers such as East River Electric and then Basin Electric. So it's a system that in our mind, of course, begins with the local people and is self-governed and democratically run by those folks. The two general managers before me in their written comments and in their verbal comments, have talked about some of the local benefits, and there certainly will be significant ones, and I appreciated Basin talking about some of the positive economic impacts. You also will see some additional reliability brought by having a generation resource in this state and in this part of the electrical transmission and distribution system. Additionally, as Mr. Marker discussed, the cooperatives in this area and throughout this region are experiencing load growth, which is a good thing. Means communities are growing, businesses are growing, and that has an accompanying need for new generation. Basin Electric and the cooperatives have put significant investment in the state of South Dakota during this last decade. You think back to the first wind turbines put in at Chamberlain, the Hyde County Wind Farm, a number of other wind farms in the region, generation resource, including some waste heat units that aren't far from here along the natural gas pipeline, planned large-scale wind farms in Day County and in some counties in North Dakota and future ones in South Dakota. These are great benefits. They're state-of-the-art resources, and being based on intermittent sources of energy, such as wind, they do require backup generation and the ability to firm it up. And that's going to be one of the advantages of this particular unit and the associated facilities is it is going to give an opportunity to provide that firming for wind power. So I think that it helps with the existing resources and lays some good groundwork for possible future additions in terms of renewables and particularly wind. And of course, we are nearly at the epicenter of wind development in South Dakota right here in White. So I know to the locals that means a lot to see that there's going to be some opportunity to look at more wind in this area and this region. So we really see some enormous benefits for this. We support both the application for siting the plant and, of course, the associated pipeline. And we would be happy to answer any questions that the commissioners, staff, or public may have. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Saar. Any questions? Comments? If you've got a question about the project, it doesn't have to be anything profound. I mean, you can certainly ask something that's been on your mind. It's a good opportunity to get that question on the record and get an answer. Good evening.
Evening. I'm Scott Underwood. I own property probably a mile from the proposed site of the plant. I have a few questions. As far as the groundwater is concerned, have you drilled and know that the groundwater is there? On top of that ridge, the groundwater is hard to find. I just wondered, what's the guarantee that you have enough groundwater? Are you estimating that you have enough? Do you actually know you have enough? And then where does the groundwater go? Where does the discharge going to end up after it's completed?
Do you have other questions on different topics?
No, I just had
perfect. Great.
Yeah,
okay.
Other questions also.
Okay, great.
Thanks for your question. I appreciate that. I'll talk about the groundwater first. We have found water on the one slide that showed the water routing. There's some land about a mile and a half of the site. We did an exploration well early last summer. We did find a good source of water, a good depth of sand and water in that area. So we're confident that we've got enough water to run the plant. We've got Banner and Associates, a local firm that has also done some water studies on that Big Sioux aquifer. And they said that the regeneration rate after our test well was very, very quick. And so we're very confident that we have enough water to supply the plant. The other question, I believe, was on the wastewater. We have not designed the full water treatment area of the plant yet. If there is any discharge at all, that will be done through the state of South Dakota through their permitting process. We have to do some analysis on the existing areas to see what that water quality is in the Deer Creek, and then we have to compare the water that we will get from the well, what that water quality is, to see if that can be discharged. If it can't, it will be taken to a suitable disposable facility.
And I wondered where the, in the state of South Dakota, where would the plant rank as far as yearly emissions compared to other industries in the state of South Dakota? I mean, is it going to be one of the top, or?
I'll let Chris speak to that, if you please.
Being that it's a combined cycle and it's burning natural gas for a fuel, the air pollution control equipment that's going to be placed on there will be a selective catalytic reduction, SCR.
Okay.
And Mr. Miller, let's get the mic a little closer because I think a little more volume will help. So okay. Maybe pull it closer.
Okay.
And then let's go ahead and start over.
Our plant will be extremely clean. You're burning natural gas as a fuel. It's very low sulfur, low particulate. There will be some NOx that will be generated, nitrogen oxides. The facility will have an SCR, a selective catalytic reduction, where they use ammonia and they oxidize the nitrogen oxide to form NO2, which is very stable in the environment. It is, as that equates to the efficiency, is extremely clean plant. It's one of the cleanest plants you can construct, as Gavin mentioned earlier, when you burn natural gas. As far as the other facilities in South Dakota, I know you have a coal-fired plant up the road. It is a whole step change below that.
I was just wondering, in our state, you know, where that might rank. How about what percentage of this power? I'm guessing that just a small percentage of this power will actually end up in the state of South Dakota. Is that true? And along with that, the last time they tried to put a transmission line in Minnesota, I don't remember. I came from Minnesota, but I don't remember if it took 12 years to get a major transmission line put in the state of Minnesota. Where's the power going to go if the transmission lines and stuff isn't there? And I was wondering what percentage of that power actually would stay in our state.
I can speak to that in general terms. The vast, I don't know. I can't give you an exact percentage. I'm sorry. But I can say that the vast majority of the electricity generated from the station will stay in the state of South Dakota. Our local members have mentioned their load growth in the area, and we're tying into the White substation, which is tied into our existing system. And so, like I said, I wish I could give you an exact number, but I can tell you that a vast majority of it is staying in South Dakota. And was there a second part of your question? I'm sorry.
The question was about whether or not transmission facilities would be necessary in Minnesota, and if so, to what extent you think that'll be possible to get those constructed.
Yeah, thank you. Becky mentioned, I think, that as part of the process, WAPA, who we're tying into their White substation, does some transmission studies to determine what, if any, upgrades are required from either their system or anybody else's system. And we haven't done those yet, but we have heard some preliminary results from folks, and they don't believe that there's going to be any additional transmission necessary other than the short line that we mentioned where we go from our plant to the White substation. That analysis will hopefully be done by the end of the year formally, but unofficially we don't believe there's going to be any major transmission needed other than that short line.
You know, they always talk about the lack of transmission lines and stuff. So when this comes in and takes up, you know, that transmission capacity, how does that affect, like, the wind projects that try to come in that need additional capacity to, you know, send their power someplace?
That I can't answer very well, other than what the Western Area Power Administration will conduct that study that does exactly what you're asking. And they take our facility, they take those megawatts, and they put it in their model. And then they take all the planned wind farms, existing wind farms, the planned wind farms, and they put that in their model. And then they run a bunch of scenarios on what if this happens, what if that happens, how stable is the grid, and if something hiccups, or you know, what's needed to fix that if this goes out. And I'm not a transmission engineer, but I can tell you they do a very thorough job of that. And that'll be, like I said, the results will that be later in this year where they finish that study. And then we're required to do that, you know, in order to connect to the WAPA substation. They make us do it so it's going to work.
Well, then my final question would be, you were talking about noise. I'll be within a mile probably of the plant. When you're talking about those decibels, what kind of noise are you talking about? I mean, I don't know what 50 decibels would be. You know, what kind of noise level is that?
My understanding, well, I do have my noise engineer behind me if you get too technical here, but a 50 decibel is something you might have in an office, 50, 60 decibels. This room right here will be in the 60 decibel range itself.
So that would be pretty low.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It was Mr. Underwood, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks very much. Other questions or comments? Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, my name is John Lieberman, and Lieberman, capital LEIFERMAN. All I go on record is I support this project 100%, and I'm a landowner right directly across the street from this project here. And I have a question. It's a gravel road there, and it can get really dusty there in the summertime. During construction, with all this significant increase in traffic, is there going to be dust control regularly?
Yes, there is. I mentioned the transportation study, and I didn't go too deep into that, but on the areas where those gravel roads, the recommendation from Burns and McDonald will be to pave 300 feet within the intersection, which is where normally starting and stopping of the intersection is where washboarding occurs. Dust control will be done on other areas to keep the dust down to a minimum. And we will work with our general work contractor in that regard to make sure that there's no impact on the neighbors.
Another question. My wife is on a township board, and a lot of these townships, if we had heavy winter, a lot of their budgets were used up on snow removal. Is there compensation? There's two little county roads there going to the south and to the west that are very small. And all this traffic here, they're going to be used extensively. And is there compensation to the townships for this?
I can tell you that we did meet with a couple of the townships, and I'm just grabbing the names here real quickly. Apologize. We met with the Richland and Sherman townships recently. And what will happen is that we will come to an agreement with those folks, a road agreement or a transportation type agreement between them and us that addresses your very question. And we have given our general work contractor candidates. We haven't let that contract yet. But we've given them a heads up that if there's any snow removal necessary, that they're going to need to find a way to make sure their workers can get to the station to do the job. We have not met yet with Alton or Lake Hendricks townships, but we intend to. We have not met with Alton or Lake Hendricks, but we intend to. And to work out the same sort of agreements with those townships also that will address those issues.
One question, I don't know if the PUC can answer this, but during when some wind tower companies were having hearings there, I remember Iberdrola suggested there was an estimated amount of income that would come into the school districts or something. Is there any estimate what this would bring into the school districts here? Maybe you can answer that.
Kurt, maybe could you speak to that? I'm not sure if we've gone to that, drill down to that detail in some of those economic studies.
No, I don't. I can't directly answer that other to say that our tax expert on staff has made an estimate of the total taxes that will be paid. How it's distributed is going to be up to the laws and regulations of South Dakota.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's all the questions I have. But I support the project, and I hope that because I'm just concerned about those township roads are so small there. How are you going to? You're talking a significant amount of traffic. Well, is the county? As you talk to the county at all? Of possibly widening these roads for this two-year span. Is there any talk with them about it?
We've met with the county, but that hasn't come up to expand those roads for this temporary construction period.
The road, both those township roads are very minimum maintenance about, and they're not very safe if you get heavy traffic there.
No, you have good concerns and good questions, and one point I want to make is that, and Kurt kind of alluded to it, is that this local review committee will be meeting, and they will come up with recommendations to the PUC for that exact sort of thing.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Lifeman, I'll make one comment. I don't know what the commission will do on this project, obviously, but with past energy conversion facilities, it has not been unusual for the commission to require a bond, that the applicant post a bond to cover damages that might happen to township or county roads as a result of the construction activities.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. I'm Mike Rifen, R-I-F-E-N, Secretary Treasurer for the Eastern South Dakota Building and Construction Trades Unions. And I'd just like to speak in favor of the project, both the pipeline and the power generation, and we look forward to helping to provide a professional workforce to get them built.
Other comments, questions?
My name is Teresa Larson. You're not going through our family farm, the REPI farm. However, my concern is a swamp area that has been donated to the Lake Hendricks, and the proposed pipeline is going through the swamp area. Is that going to be causing a problem in cleaning up the Lake Hendricks area?
If I understand your question correctly, you're concerned about our pipeline route near the western edge of Lake Hendricks?
Yes, it's going through the swampland area, which was just donated to the Hendricks Association to clean up the lake.
I've become aware of a project where you're looking at cleaning some water.
Yeah.
Kind of like a pre-filter process before it goes into Lake Hendricks.
Steve Hemmings would probably know more about the project than I do.
Yeah.
No? Okay.
But my understanding with our pipeline going in place and we're hugging the roadway, now whether it's a compatible use, our pipeline will be below grade, 4 feet under once it's in place.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, it's below any impacts, but for what we understand right now, there shouldn't be any impacts to what I understand of your project.
Okay, thank you. I am in support of the project, but that was my only concern.
I think this is a good example of where, you know, questions raised today, you know, the commission can also keep that in consideration. We can ask some follow-up questions. You know, specifically as we analyze along the route. So I think that's a good issue to have raised. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Good evening, Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Hill, Brookings County Zoning Director, and I just want to say we appreciate Basin Electric being upfront and giving the county all the plans and the routes and everything ahead of time. That allows us, we haven't had our conditional use hearings yet, but the county commission as a whole, we support the county commission supports the program, and as a zoning director, my zoning board would give it a fair hearing as any other conditional use permit. Thank you.
Max, would you like everyone to spell their last name? Is that helpful? Okay. Perfect. Great.
Good evening. My name is Todd Kays, K-A-Y-S. I am the Executive Director of the First Planning District of the First District Association of Local Governments in Watertown, South Dakota. Just wanted to briefly talk a little bit about the district and where we see our role in this process. We represent 11 counties and 74 communities in Northeast South Dakota. We provide technical assistance in a wide variety of areas. We've been around for about 38 years. We're a creature of state government created by executive order in 1971 by Governor Farrar at that time. While we are under contract with Basin Electric to do the socioeconomic analysis for their project and also for part of their environmental impact statement, I just wanted to state that we're continuously under contract for our 11 counties and 74 communities, of which Brookings and Dual and the communities within those counties are all members of our association. So we wanted to make sure that we did used extreme due diligence when we were conducting the work for Basin, because we felt like we were doing the work for our members, our dues-paying members as well. And that's all I really wanted to state tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
My name is Bob Kurtz. I'm a local farmer. I farm in the area where the project is going to be, and I'm totally support it. I have a concern about the bridge that is over Deer Creek on 484. Understanding there will be a jumper bridge over it, and right now that bridge really, I think it's on the list of being replaced. I guess I would like to see the bridge replaced if it could, without taking out the jumper bridge and then having our old bridge back. It's limited in what we can cross with farm equipment, and also width restriction. We have to go around, and there isn't roads everywhere there, so it's a real inconvenience with the bridge we have. I guess I don't understand why the jumper bridge and then keep our old bridge. I would like to see a bridge put in that would last and be taken care of. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment. Maybe I'll clarify that transportation study that Burns and McDonald did was a recommendation at this point. And we have, I mentioned before, we're going to be entering into a general work contract to actually build the project. And those folks will hire a, what they call a heavy haul contractor. And that person has not been hired. We had a heavy haul contractor look at the area to come up with a route. And it was them that recommended the jumper bridge along with Burns and McDonald. That being said, once the general work contract is let and the heavy haul contract is let formally, those folks will then take another look at that bridge and decide if a jumper bridge is the most economical way to get done what we need to get done. I can't speak to the condition of the bridge other than it is in not very good shape, and they took a look at that and said, okay, economically, how do we get this heavy equipment to the site? And the most economical way at this point is with a jumper bridge. Beyond that, I can't really speak to that question other than once we get the heavy haul contractor hired, they will take another look at it. But for our project, our needs are to get heavy equipment to the site, and the jumper bridge was the most economical way to do that.
Mr. Kurtz, did we get your question answered? And so as a follow-up, I mean, it's possible that further analysis may identify that the jumper bridge is not the low-cost option?
It's possible, but they did take a look at it, and that's what they came up with for now, but they will take another look at it once that contract is let.
And is it possible that Basin Electric would, I mean, if a local government in the area that had responsibility for that bridge wanted to talk with you about maybe them getting a new bridge and you contributing to that to the extent, to the same cost that jumper bridge might have cost? I mean, is that an option?
Yes, we're always willing to talk to the local areas as part of the siting process to figure out what's the best for our project and our neighbors.
Gotcha, perfect. Other questions? Well, while we give you a moment to collect your thoughts, we will reiterate that this is not your last opportunity to make your voice heard. Certainly, the commission is happy to take receive at our office emails, telephone calls, and letters. Letters and emails are very easily put into the record of this proceeding, and the commissioners will certainly consider them all before making any decision. And we'll take those right up until the time when we render a decision, and even thereafter. Other questions or comments? Other questions or comments? Well, we'll ask once more if there are any other questions or comments. If there aren't any, I believe there are still cookies and punch left. And we want to thank you all for coming this evening. Please make sure you sign in the back. And thank you to the applicant as well. Have a good evening.